When loyalists came to abduct Papa, we were better off for having been forewarned. If I should need to fear a tomahawk splintering our stair rail, I'd rather you tell me. Hamilton grimaced, as if not realizing I was making a jest.
Just don't open the door to strangers.
December 12, 1792, Philadelphia.
I shouldn't be able to remember the chill in my bones that wintry night, or the little mewling cries of my newborn who awakened me for milk. But I do remember. I remember how I climbed from our bed and took the candle into the nursery, only to find my daughter Anna already there, staring out the window that overlooked the street.
"Bad men are coming to get us, Mama," she whispered, standing at the window.
With a freckled nose and dark auburn hair, she was an imaginative child who invented beautiful songs and countless ways to amuse herself. But like her father, she was easily agitated.
"Why are you awake, my darling? No one is coming. It's only your dreams."
I shooed her back to bed before I saw them. Two shadowy men lingering across the way near the president's house. They stooped in the darkness against a low brick wall, the light of a lantern between them, their breaths puffing into the air. Then a newcomer joined, a lady. Though no woman of good reputation would be on the streets alone with two men at this hour. They bent their heads, motioning toward our house. Then these plotters, these obvious ne'er-do-wells, sent her, a slender slip of a thing, to climb our icy stairs and rap at our front door. Don't open the door to strangers. Still cradling our babe, I remembered my husband's admonition, and a shudder ran through me as I realized how easily he might be lured outside by a young woman pretending at distress. Rushing to our room, I found Alexander already donning a robe.
"Don't answer," I said,
hurriedly telling him what I'd seen.
"I'm sure it's nothing," he replied, retrieving a pistol,
one I hadn't guessed he kept in a drawer by the bed until that very moment.
"But I will be cautious."
I stood at the landing, listening as he made some low murmuring answer to the woman at the door, sending her away. But when he didn't come back up, I went down to find him seated on the bottom stair, his head in his hands. I went to him, filled with dread.
"What is it? What's happened?"
I took his hand. That's when I realized he was cold, his fingers gone to ice, and given his obvious torment, I could do nothing but guess.
Good news did not come in the dead of night.
Remembering how learning of John Lawrence's death had so devastated Alexander, I could only imagine the news was of a similar nature now. So I feared it was Lafayette, another brother-at-arms who last we'd heard awaited execution in a prison. Contrary to Mr. Jefferson's sunny predictions, the French Revolution had taken a very dark turn. A political faction calling themselves Jacobins had somehow seized the reins of government, arrested the French king, and condemned Lafayette as a traitor. Our French friend had fled France, but had been captured and imprisoned in neighboring Austria, last we heard.
"Is he dead?" I asked,
my throat tightening with emotion as I knelt beside my husband, preparing for bitter grief. For a time, it had seemed as if we could save Lafayette. My husband supported the president's effort to formally request Lafayette's release. Our ambassadors, William Short and Governor Morris, tried to negotiate his freedom. In London, Angelica recruited rescuers to break Lafayette out of prison. Even Secretary Jefferson discovered a loophole by which payment for Lafayette's war service could be sent for the upkeep of his family. Lafayette was the one thing all American factions agreed upon. But now I feared all efforts to save him had failed.
"Has he been executed?"
"Who?"
Alexander asked blankly.
"The Marquis," I said, as much bewildered as relieved. "Have you received news?"
"Bad news," he said, but not of Lafayette. There is something I must tell you, my angel.
I nodded, steeling myself, even as relief flooded through me that it was no bad news about our friend, and I hoped he still survived.
There's been a fraud in the Treasury Department involving stolen war pensions.
I let out a breath, for it was merely a government matter, though why such a thing would be communicated in the midnight and by a woman at that I couldn't imagine. How terrible. I hope the culprits may be prosecuted to the full extent.
They won't be,
Alexander replied, his voice now as shaky as his hands.
Three of Mr. Jefferson's partisans have, as a consequence of this, begun an investigation into my conduct.
Your conduct? I asked, stunned. My husband's gaze fell away. He tried to speak, but from that notoriously eloquent mouth came naught but silence. In the hurry to put together a Treasury Department, my husband had trusted the wrong people. His former assistant had only recently been thrown into debtor's prison for speculation schemes, setting off a financial panic. Now, some corrupt clerk had stolen government documents right under Alexander's nose.
They're going to blame you.
Hamilton glanced at me, then away again.
They'll blame me for the fraud and for anything else they can lay at my doorstep. Speculation, corruption. These are the charges.
Suddenly my husband leaped to his feet, pacing, while I tried to rub the chill from my arms.
And Jefferson's paper once called me a cowardly assassin who strikes in the night.
I thought to quiet him so as not to wake the children, but it was better to see him angry than anguished, better by far. My husband was quite possibly the most combative man I knew, and if he was ready to fight, he would win. Have a word with Madison, I suggested. Whatever your disagreements, he knows your character and—
Madison is my personal and political enemy now,
Alexander insisted.
To think I once mistook him as being naive but incorruptible. The sort of man who has so many slaves at his beck and call that he's seldom had so much as to wipe himself clean in the privy.
That's hardly fair, I said. I knew he was angry with Madison. I was too. But I didn't want to believe we were enemies.
Isn't it? Madison has fallen entirely under the spell of Jefferson's utopian philosophies. Either that, or Madison has always been a facile, deceitful little man. He won't help me.
At a loss as to what else to do, I followed my husband into his study, where broken feather pens littered his desk, and an untidy stack of books made me feel a neglectful housekeeper. My hands to my face, I shook my head. Alexander, none of this makes any sense. Why would a woman come to the house in the middle of the night to tell you this?
On a groan, he braced against the top of his desk. They must have believed it was the only way I'd open the door.
I heard what he said, but his explanation only added to my confusion. But why would they use a woman to communicate the charges? Who are these investigators?
Monroe is one,
Hamilton answered, bitterly. Well, that was some good news. Whatever the other Virginians might do, Monroe had fought in the war beside my husband. He'll exonerate you when he finds no evidence of wrongdoing. He might chastise you for hiring scoundrels, but he'll see you're not guilty. Guilty. That word made my husband wince. Why should that be? He wasn't guilty. He couldn't be guilty. Not my honorable husband. He could never be involved in a scheme to cheat soldiers' families and defraud the treasury. And yet, he stared bleakly out the frosted window onto the now empty street. Alexander, tell me you had nothing to do with these swindlers. I expected he'd fly into high dudgeon at the mere suggestion. At the very least, he should have turned to shout, "Good God, woman, is that what you think of me?" But instead, to my increasing dread, the man who was almost never at a loss for words still said nothing.
the bottom of my stomach fell away. I could not, would not believe that my husband would steal from the treasury, for even if he were such a knave, such a blackguard, he was a man of such brilliance and easy financial connections that he could find 1,000 untraceable ways to make a fortune. Yet in the back of my mind, a treasonous thought lingered. Is this why he thought we could afford a new and bigger house? All at once, my husband said my name with another groan.
Betsy, my God, what have I done?
With that, he sank to his knees, pressing his cheek against my belly in supplication, and I felt heartsick. What had he done? To see my husband, my strong, proud husband, who could face bayonets and cannon fire, on his knees before me was too much. Not knowing what else to do, I stroked his hair. And then, to my horror, he wept.
I'm sorry. So sorry.
Oh, no, Alexander. Tears pricking at my eyes in a panic, I insisted. You didn't betray your country. You couldn't.
I didn't betray my country.
He made fists of my sleeping gown as he rasped.
I betrayed you.
It all came out then, in a pleading, impassioned confession, as if he were arguing before judge and jury. But I heard it as if through a tunnel, as if I'd floated away and watched us from a distance. A woman had come to our door more than a year ago with a tale of woe, abandoned by an abusive husband and left in a strange city with her little daughter. A story tailor-made to appeal to my husband's sensibilities. My husband, the bastard of just such an abandoned woman. My husband, the special patron of orphaned children. Suddenly, the woman sent to our door made much more sense.
It was a trap, he explained, his eyes imploring me. My enemies must have known I would feel pity for her circumstances. This woman, this Maria Reynolds, she pleaded for money, just enough to return to her Livingston relations in New York.
The Livingstons? Kitty's family was somehow a part of this?
I took her for a respectable lady,
Alexander continued,
at least until I delivered the money to her at her house, where she led me to her bedroom and—
Oh, God! I murmured, a wave of nausea washing over me. How had it taken me this long to understand what he was confessing? Adultery. He was confessing adultery. Sweet, saintly, stupid Betsy. Look hard enough and there's always a woman, my sister had said. And I'd dismissed it, smugly refusing to believe anything or anyone could ever come between us. Now, Hamilton looked up with tears in his eyes.
My darling, please.
Oh, God, I said again, jerking away from the grip of his hands. Hands that I'd supposed to have touched only me since we'd wed. His hands, his lips, his... He clutched me like a drowning man, still explaining.
Mr. Reynolds discovered his wife's infidelity and threatened to tell you if I didn't pay him.
He kept talking and talking now. But I could scarcely hear a word because my mind whirled in a tornado of questions and confusion. Was Maria Reynolds beautiful? Even Angelica agreed that Alexander appreciated beautiful art, beautiful furniture, beautiful music. My husband had an eye for beauty in everything. Oh, God! Was that Mrs. Reynolds who'd been at our door just now?
Betsy, you must believe me, Hamilton pleaded. It was done by design to tempt me.
He wanted some answer of me, some reply, but I was too much in a daze, too lost in a barrage of brutal imaginings. Did he kiss the back of her neck, the way he kissed mine? Did she smell of sweet perfume or a lustful feminine musk instead of milk and sweat and motherhood like me? Hamilton finally rose and pressed his forehead to mine.
You must say something, my angel, if only to condemn me for the sinner I am. You must say something.
But I said nothing at all, because words were his weapon. Silence was mine, and he couldn't win an argument if I didn't start one. Instead, in agony, I slipped from his grasp and seemed to float up the stairs, light and insubstantial, as if I meant nothing to anyone, not even myself. I'd been the woman Alexander Hamilton chose to love, and was, therefore, of consequence in the world. What was I now? Inconsequential. If this story was true, if it was real and not some nightmare, I couldn't shake myself awake, but perhaps if I went back to sleep. And so I scooped our newborn baby into my arms and crawled back into bed. But then I got back up and turned the key in the lock to keep my husband out.
Betsy. Knocking followed. Please open the door.
The humility in my husband's voice, a voice that was never humble, told me it was no dream or nightmare. And in any case, I hadn't slept.
For that matter, neither had he.
He'd been calling quietly for several hours now, and I'd been pretending not to hear. I couldn't bear to see him. The only person I wanted to see was Angelica, the only person I could tell, the only person who would understand and keep my secret. Could I go to her? Simply wander in my sleeping gown to the docks and sail across the sea to my sister's arms? I supposed that was a fantasy, much like the life I'd been living, believing in a man who'd betrayed me. This man who'd allowed me to believe that I knew him so intimately. He was a stranger. It was only after nursing the baby, passing water into a chamber pot and washing my hands and face, that I finally unlocked the bedroom door to find Hamilton there, his eyes bloodshot. "Well?" I asked, wondering what he could possibly have to say for himself.
"I must dress," he whispered apologetically. "I have an early appointment."
Of course he did. Alexander Hamilton was a very important man, and I was just a betrayed wife. The business of the government and his all-important administration would go on. So I sat at the edge of the bed, careful not to disturb our sleeping son, and watched my husband dress. At the appearance of his strong, well-formed arms, his naked torso as he stripped off his sleeping garments, I felt a stab of renewed pain. He was still as handsome as he'd been as a young officer, perhaps more so now, with a little gray at his temples, wearing a mantle of gravitas. Any woman would want him. Every woman did want him. And once, at least, he'd wanted them back, an instinct I'd been naive enough to believe love and piety held at bay in the dozen years since we'd taken our vows. Now I couldn't stand the sight of him, so my gaze fell to our son. "Was her child there when you made love to her?" We both startled at my question, for I hadn't meant to speak. And I doubt those were the words he'd expected to hear from me.
"Dear God, Betsy, it wasn't love. I've told you—"
"You said she had a daughter," I broke in, unwilling to allow him to make a jury argument. "Where was the child when you went to this woman's bed?"
A flush of scarlet crept up his bared chest. "The child was sleeping behind a curtain. You must understand, it was a very squalid little apartment, to give the impression—" He trailed off, perhaps realizing that the picture he painted didn't make a better case. "It was a sin."
He knew adultery was against the laws of God. I'd be lying to say that the sin against the Lord pained me more than the sin against me. But I didn't feel worthy enough in this moment to think his crimes against me merited notice. For he'd made true every ugly bit of gossip I'd ever heard or read about in the papers, and they all rushed back to me now. He's a ginger tomcat. I doubt I'm the only lady to which he has pleaded. But the war. He'll surrender his sword to any pretty girl who wants it. 3 by my count in the last month alone.
He will not be bound by even the most solemn of all obligations, wedlock.
I'd prided myself on being such a practical woman. But I suppose I must have been a dreamer to believe that ours was a marriage of true hearts. And now, as all my illusions were most cruelly stripped away, I found that I couldn't ask the questions I wanted to ask for fear of the answer. Is she prettier? More interesting? Do I not satisfy him? Had I ever satisfied him? Was it only the one time? Was it only the one woman? I'd be a fool to ask, and I didn't want to be a fool ever again.
They want to ruin me with this, Betsy.
He sat beside me.
They can't win an argument against me. They can't win a vote against me. So they used the only true weakness I have. You.
As if I were the liability. I gave an indignant little snort. I mean nothing to you.
He winced. Never say it. You're my angel. My beloved.
I am not beloved, I hissed, lurching off the bed away from him.
You are, he insisted, coming to take my chin and forcing me to look at him. It would never have come to this if I didn't love you, after all.
I quite nearly slapped his hand away. Was he blaming me? I was struck with a memory of the time I refused him when he bent me over the table, of nights I'd been tired, or suffered a headache, or was preoccupied with the children. A wife had a duty to satisfy her husband's needs, and this I'd apparently not done. But the only thing worse than to hear him blame me now would be to accept the blame. I simply refused. Faced with my quiet, defiant fury, he reached to tuck a tendril of hair behind my ear, but I flinched, and he dropped his hand.
Betsy, they could never have blackmailed me if it weren't for my love for you. Your happiness is most dear to me. How could I, but with extreme pain, wish to inflict you with this confession?
The confession is not what afflicts me. He cleared his throat.
You're the only person I dread to disappoint. If Reynolds had threatened me with death, I'd have faced it more manly than the specter of hurting you. To prevent that, I would have paid nearly any price.
I don't believe you, I whispered, seething.
Yes, you do, Hamilton said. And you must forgive me.
Oh, must I? The look I gave him should have turned him to stone. Somehow it did not.
I surrendered to temptation, and I ask your forgiveness. Remember, Betsy, that you are a Christian. That he should dare throw that in my face.
Yes, God commanded forgiveness. Perhaps that should have been enough to soften my heart and resign me to the difficulties of this marriage that I'd undertaken in the Lord's name. But it wasn't. Wrapping my arms around myself, as if to guard from the chill in my own voice, I asked, Would you forgive me if I surrendered to such temptation? He reeled back like a man kicked by a horse. It was a moment before he could even muster the composure to argue.
An unfaithful husband cannot be compared to an unfaithful wife, whose actions cast doubt on the legitimacy of their children.
And what man would—
He stopped abruptly, before he said worse. But I had a suspicion as to what he'd been thinking, and rounded on him. If you think I've not had need of avoiding the affections of other men, I'd disabuse you of that notion now.
No, of course, that is not.
His color deepening, he interrupted himself to ask, What men? Name these men who have pressed affections on my wife, and I shall call them out. Call them out? I laughed darkly. You, prostrate with your own crimes, shall call for a duel of honor? Our voices awakened the baby, who gave a stretch and half-hearted cry before settling again. My husband was too clever a man not to realize his blunder, but was too hot-tempered to retract. Instead, he took me by the arms and gave me a little shake.
Let us reach an understanding, you and I. You would never betray me, Betsy. It isn't in you. But I would forgive you if you did. Do you understand? I'd forgive you anything so long as you loved me,
for love is the power that binds us. That and our children and the life we have together.
I'd forgive you anything so long as you loved me.
He'd turned upon me the full blaze of his extraordinary blue eyes, the heat of his body, the power of his charisma and an appeal to our love, and yet, I whispered,
I don't believe you.
His grip tightened. You do believe me. I've caused you pain, but I love you. Deep in your heart, you know it's true.
What did that matter?
My heart, after all, had proved to be an untrustworthy instrument. The only thing I could rely upon was my head and cold, hard reason, and so I asked.
What price did you pay?
You said you paid the man. How much? He swallowed hard and stared a long moment. Just over $1,000.
Nearly a third of his income in any given year.
A sum so shocking that I pushed his hands away.
Please tell me, at the very least, it was your own money.
I bit out. God, of course. I couldn't bear for you to find out, Betsy. Would a man who did not love you pay so much?
He meant this to be a branch for me to cling to while I drowned in humiliation. I grasped at it, only for my sanity. Well, now I know.
So they have nothing more to hold over you. He blanched. They do. That's why he was at the door last night. Reynolds has been released from jail, but if I don't get him clear of the fraud charges, he'll tell a story to the investigators. I cannot do what he wishes, but I will meet with him this morning and persuade him to keep quiet anyway.
Now we come to the real reason for this confession, I thought. He's been forced to it. For there was, indeed, something Hamilton dreaded more than my discovery of his infidelity. And that was an end to his administration. He believed that in these early years of the American experiment, faith in him was the same as faith in the government he served. That if Hamilton was thought to be corrupted, the system he built would collapse. Alas, I couldn't say that he was wrong. Now, spent of his confessions, my husband eased himself back upon the bed and nestled our baby boy in his arms. Stroking Johnny's peach fuzz head, Hamilton whispered,
I know I've done wrong, Betsy. Even if you forgive me, I cannot forgive myself for risking that our children be thought the descendants of a thief who stole from the country he was entrusted to defend. I have only ever wished to give my sons an honorable name in which to take pride.
An honorable name. It's all my husband ever wanted.
And when his father hadn't given it to him, he made one for himself out of nothing but sweat and courage. Now that name belonged to our children, and should our children suffer for their father's sins? Though I should be weeping, in that moment I was too numb to fall to pieces. For a long moment, my head was a maelstrom of confusion. But then clarity stole through. You cannot rely on your blackmailer to keep quiet. Better to summon the investigators, tell them the truth, and throw yourself upon their mercy as gentlemen to keep your private failings in confidence.
Summon them here? Hamilton's eyes flew open. With you and the children?
I nodded, swallowing over fury and pain. Invite them into our home. Let them see me and your little ones. Remind them who will pay the price for wagging tongues. As if apprehending what I'd have to endure, he groaned.
I couldn't ask you to do this for me.
Good thing, because I would not do it for you.
I would do it for my children. It was, after all, the only wise politic choice. And Alexander Hamilton had, at long last, made me a politician.
Chapter 23 Reynolds, Reynolds, Reynolds. As I kneaded dough, I couldn't get the name out of my head. Sure, I could place it. Maria Reynolds was a harlot, my husband insisted. A woman whose husband prostituted her. A woman beneath my contempt. I imagined her as a dainty sparrow of a thing. The kind who might flutter about, as if with a broken wing in need of tending.
Ought I do the same when the investigators came to my house?
I was broken in earnest, heartbroken. And perhaps if I showed that heartbreak, it would evoke sympathy. Or perhaps it would subject me to their laughter.
James Monroe would never laugh at me, I thought. In loyalty to my husband, I'd never attempted to untangle or name my feelings for Monroe or his for me. But I'd always believed our connection to be deeper and more complicated than friendship. Monroe was the first man to stir romantic feelings in my breast, a man with whom I felt a kinship in wanderlust and passion for the cause. He would have never broken my heart, nor would have Tench Tillman for that matter. If I'd made a match with either of them, good soldiers, solid gentlemen with respectable upbringings and a concern for morality, I wouldn't be suffering this now. But I'd chosen Alexander Hamilton. A fact I reminded myself of as I methodically scraped the loaf of sugar for a confection I couldn't taste, for the world had become devoid of flavor. I could scarcely see color, which made it a trial to choose what to wear. If I wore something dark and plain, would the investigators feel sorrier for me? Or perhaps I should wear my gauzy white dress, the one that left less of my body to the imagination, so they'd think my husband a fool for betraying me. I was never a beauty. It was only that, until a few days ago, Alexander had made me feel like one. Now I felt like nothing. That night the investigators came to my house, just as I'd suggested. Two legislators I knew by name only, a Treasury official and James Monroe. While my girls played by the fireplace with their new toys, brought by Sinterklaas in burlap sacks days before, I welcomed the man into the house with a plate of rye flour pepernut cookies, fragrant with cinnamon, anise, and clove.
"Compliments of the season,"
Monroe drawled, with a very formal bow that seemed somehow at odds with his brown hunting boots and the black tricorn beaver felt hat that was swiftly going out of style. Meanwhile, my boys ran about like rowdies, led by a laughing, taunting 10-year-old Philip, pelting one another with extra pepernut they'd stolen from the kitchen, which was not strictly the custom. But I was too weary to take a firm hand with them, especially when I had grown men to manage. "Coffee?" I asked Monroe, forcing a smile.
"What else?"
Monroe chuckled softly, as if a little abashed to be upon this errand, and as if, perhaps, he thought I didn't know why he'd come. Clearing his throat, he said,
"Mrs. Monroe sends her warm regards."
"And I return mine. I hope to see your wife and your darling little daughter at a holiday tea after church this Sunday." Monroe's smile warmed, so I added, "We've come such a long way from an army campfire, haven't we, Senator Monroe?"
"Indeed we have. How young, hopeful, and idealistic we were."
"I am still hopeful," I said, filling his cup to the brim just as bitterness filled me up inside. Once I'd finished serving refreshments, Alexander stood, ready to furnish all the information they could require to acquit him of a crime. Receipts of his blackmail payments, I assumed. So I retired from the room and kept the children quiet upstairs. It was quiet downstairs, too. Maddeningly so. I didn't know what to make of it, especially when the men remained closeted together much longer than I thought necessary. Indeed, the interview seemed to go on and on until I grew weary watching the hands on our grandfather clock move. When, at last, I heard the scrape of chair legs on wood, the sound of a meeting reaching its end, I hastened downstairs again. Alexander should have seen the man off. But I'd persuaded him that I should be the one to do it. And so I forced myself to say a kindly and proper farewell. Given what my husband had just told them, I wasn't surprised that the investigators whom I didn't know well couldn't meet my eyes. But James Monroe's face burned scarlet at the sight of me, and he lingered in the doorway long after the others departed, a sheaf of papers under his arm.
With a shake of his head, he began to stammer.
Mrs. Hamilton. Betsy.
It had been a long time since he used my name with that soft southern drawl. The intimacy of it seemed somehow improper, but the sound of it carried genuine sympathy. Oh, why had I feared the men's laughter instead of their pity? Pity was worse, far worse, especially from him. Though I wanted to flee, I somehow made myself stand there and say, "I trust you're satisfied with my husband's innocence on the charge of corruption." Monroe's color deepened, if that was possible, at the word innocence. In fact, he cast such a bloody-minded look in the direction of the study that I feared it had all gone badly.
"Secretary Hamilton has provided me with exculpatory documentation, and we will not make any report to the President at this time. I believe your husband will acknowledge that our conduct toward him has been fair and liberal, and that he could not complain of it."
Oh, Alexander would complain of it. But he should be grateful for Monroe, who actually cared whether or not he complained. And I could see that Monroe cared very much.
"Mrs. Hamilton, please believe that I wish you every happiness."
Monroe had flushed at the word innocence, but now I blanched at the word happiness. He noticed, and all pretense fell away. Either I was no good at pretense, or he knew me well enough to realize that I was aware of my husband's infidelity.
"You are a kind, lovely, and charming woman, and you deserve much better than—"
"Pray don't say another word," I whispered, wilting with humiliation. Why did I think I could do this? Why did I think I was strong enough? To my horror, tears welled before I could blink them away. "I should plead for your discretion as a gentleman on behalf of my husband, but in truth, I beg of you, for myself—"
"Dear God, to see you cry,"
Monroe said, setting down the papers and reaching inside his sleeve for an embroidered kerchief, which he offered me at once.
"In so far as is in keeping with my duty, the papers will remain sealed, as will my lips for your sake. You have my word of honor."
His kerchief smelled faintly of tobacco and pine, and I let out a tiny sob into it, full of relief and sorrow. It would be better if no one knew what Hamilton had done. No one. Not my friends, not my parents, not even Angelica. For such things could never be entrusted to a letter across the ocean. So the only person to whom I could confide was James Monroe. "The tears will pass," I said, trying for bravery. "It's only the lingering shame."
"Not your shame," Monroe said, his fists tightening,
as if he meant to turn, march back into my husband's study, and beat him. "Nevertheless, I don't know how I can bear it." Monroe didn't have to be told how society looked upon a wife who wasn't enough to satisfy her husband. "Not enough, not enough, not enough." As these words battered my insides, I felt undone, quite low, indescribably miserable, vulnerable in every way. And so I was grateful when, with exquisite chivalry, Monroe drew my hand to his lips for a gentlemanly kiss.
"The girl I met in Albany, who could gamely drink some poison concoction without complaint, play a ruthless game of backgammon, and set off into the wilds in a sleigh, that girl could bear anything."
"That girl is long gone."
"She's still here,"
Monroe said, offering a tender smile and pressing my hand for just a moment to his heart.
"Where she will always reside. My dear friend, I've held on to those memories, and I urge you to hold on to them, too."
My breath evened at the unexpected intimacy, at the strong pulse beneath my palm, at the knowledge that there were paths in my life I had not taken, and the glimmer of hope that even if I couldn't see past my own sadness now, there might still be new paths to discover.
"Thank you,"
I whispered.
Monroe nodded gravely. "Your husband is the luckiest of men, and I hope at long last he realizes it."
He didn't need to give me that one small bit of flattery. Perhaps he shouldn't have. But it was a mercy, and it gave me the strength to dry my tears. When I was composed again, I found a plate for him, covered in a white linen napkin. "Pastries for Mrs. Monroe." He smiled when our fingers brushed lightly as he took the plate. "Perhaps we can all share them together in more sociable circumstances." Alas, there would never be more sociable circumstances for us. Not ever again. April, 1793, Philadelphia.
Vive la République.
While I made my way through the crowds, church bells rang, cannons blasted, and Philadelphians sang in honor of the French, who had outlawed the monarchy, beheaded their king, and now found themselves at war with Great Britain. In spite of our old treaty with France, President Washington had declared American neutrality in this war, but everywhere I went, my countrymen took up the cry of our old allies, "Vive la République!" On this day, the celebration was for the arrival of a frigate the French had taken from the British. Upon her coming into sight, thousands and thousands of the yeomanry of the city crowded the wharves, and when the British colors appeared reversed, the French flying above them, people burst into peals of exultation. But I wasn't in this squalid part of Philadelphia to celebrate. I'd come for a less dignified reason, one that wisdom should have cautioned me against. In the aftermath of my husband's betrayal, I'd spent a dark, miserable winter on my knees in prayer. Now springtime had stolen upon me, insulting me with its showy, colorful, perfumed glory. And I had to see her. I had to see Maria Reynolds. "Men stray," my sister Angelica would have told me. I could hear her words as if she were standing beside me, warning me to leave off this nonsense. "It's in their nature. You're making too much of it. Your husband still loves you, and you're lucky to have him." Certainly, since Hamilton's midnight confession, he'd been solicitous, sharing in the care of the children, staying home at night, and sheepishly turning down meetings with colleagues in deference, he said, to his growing and hitherto too much neglected family. But in recent weeks, more confessions had spilled from his lips. It was not, as he'd first intimated, just one night with this woman. For nearly a year, he'd gone to her bed, and I, the trusting fool, had never suspected. And when I demanded to know why he'd not simply told me everything all at once, he said, "I thought you might take easier to a thing if it was gradually broken to you, my angel." Which left me to wonder what other painful revelations remained. I knew my husband regretted this woman. I also knew most wives overlooked infidelity. Only a select few divorced. But in New York State, adultery was the only grounds upon which a woman could seek a divorce. And I will not say I didn't flirt with the thought at night, in our now very cold bed. But to what end? It wouldn't undo the pain. And who would I be if I wasn't Alexander Hamilton's wife? Weeping into the kerchief Monroe had pressed into my hand, while offering comfort and strength, I felt as much a stranger to myself as Hamilton was now to me. I scarcely spoke to my husband, beyond that which was necessary for the children's sake, and I felt too exhausted to care for my own dignity. The need to see Maria Reynolds became a compulsion, perhaps as powerful as the one that led my husband to her in the first place. Which was how, after a few discreet inquiries, I found myself at the corner, near the public square, staring up at Maria's window in the house she shared with men it would be too kind to characterize as genteel boarders. Her curtains had been thrown back, allowing me to watch her brush her long hair. Fair hair. Would it have been better if she'd been a brunette? Maria was beautiful. Young. And overtaken with some sort of madness, I meant to confront her. I would shame her, make her feel the shame I felt. I would demand to know why she'd hurt my family and wrecked my happiness.
Pushing through the crowds, I marched up the stairs to her weathered, red-painted door. But as I reached for the knocker, the dark spell was broken by the laughter of a little girl coming from her window. Her daughter. A poor, innocent child with an unfeeling father, a harlot for a mother and no future whatsoever. Oh, the folly in coming here. It crashed over me in another wave of shame. To stoop to converse with a prostitute, to demean myself. If I couldn't forgive this, then I must forget it. Forget her, and be gone from this place before someone wondered what the wife of the Treasury Secretary was doing lingering near what must have been known as a bawdy house. Unfortunately, it wasn't easy to leave. Not with the parading crowds. I was forced to combat the press of bodies, the scent of sweat, the indifferent shuffling of so many feet. Vivid memories of the doctor's riots making me anxious. To break free of the crowd, I'm afraid I wielded my parasol with unladylike force, but there was no fighting the rush of so many. Vive la République! Vive la République! Vive la République! I was swept along the streets of Philadelphia for half a block before I was rescued, veritably plucked from a churning sea of people by a very tall, freckled man in an exquisite French suit with fine lace cuffs.
Why, Mrs. Hamilton,
Jefferson drawled, gently pulling me to the relative calm of the corner curbside, where he stood with James Madison.
What a surprise to see you here.
My heart sank. I could think of no two persons I should least like to have discovered me so near to Maria Reynolds. And my mind spun with a persecuted turn, not unlike my husband's. Hamilton had said that his political enemies lured him into the scandal, and I'd dismissed it as a paranoid and egotistical excuse. But if his foes learned of the affair, they might use it. I wanted to trust that these Virginians were gentlemen, that they'd never serve us up to the public. But if my own husband couldn't be trusted, why should I trust anything? Or anyone? I was on my way home, I said, trying to catch my breath, hating the edge of fear in my voice, and unable to think of an able lie that would avert their suspicions, if they had suspicions. By God, what a misery to think like Hamilton, wondering at some poison in every person's smile. I felt guilty for it when Madison offered me an arm with genuine concern.
Are you quite all right, Mrs. Hamilton?
Just alarmed by the crowds, I said. The cultured Secretary Jefferson casually pressed his back against the bricks, as if he cared little for keeping his satin coat clean. From his lofty height, he surveyed the vista with his eyes he shielded from the sun and pronounced,
"There is no need for alarm, madam. Why, I think I spy your boy just across the way, having hoisted himself onto a barrel for a better view."
"My boy?" I asked, sure he was mistaken.
"Young Philip," he said, pointing. "There with my youngest daughter, Polly. Perhaps we may make a match of them."
It was meant in jest, and yet I didn't laugh. "My son should be at home." Jefferson gave a sunny smile.
"Ah, but it's too marvelous a day to be inside. The spirit of 76 is in the air."
The spirit of revolution, he meant. And I was struck with the impression that Jefferson still fancied himself a revolutionary in search of a tyrant to tear down, instead of a statesman charged with a new government to build. Thus, with a meaningful look at Madison, I couldn't help retorting, "I prefer the spirit of 87. That was the year we forged a constitution, and I doubted Madison missed my meaning.
"Either way," Jemmy replied, "a marvelous celebratory day for the revolution."
He spoke of it as if it were ongoing, as if the French Revolution was a part of our own. And I knew I should have nodded politely and made chit-chat about the weather, but nearly confronting Maria had left me agitated enough to say instead, "I'm afraid I cannot celebrate violence."
"Oh?"
Madison asked, because inside that owlish head was a whirling brain that missed nothing. He knew that I had celebrated our soldiers, our war, our victories, and he probably thought me a rank hypocrite.
Despite the follies and barbarities in Paris, the French Revolution has been wonderful in its progress and stupendous in its consequences.
He was wrong. The French Revolution was devolving into anarchy. I knew. Certainly, I knew not to argue with these men. Especially here and now. How often had I counseled my husband to govern his tongue? And yet now, unmoored by my anger at my husband, mine flew free. It certainly is stupefying that a revolution inspired by our own should turn upon those who fought heroically in the cause of our freedom. Rochambeau and Lafayette both in prison. At the mention of Lafayette, Jefferson's voice gentled, and his clear blue eyes filled with sympathy.
Mrs. Hamilton, my own affections have also been deeply wounded by some of the martyrs to this cause. But the liberty of the whole earth depends on this contest. And rather than it should fail, I would see half the earth desolated. An Adam and an Eve left in every country and left free, it would be better than it now is.
Though the season was not cold, goose flesh rose on my arms. What a strange man to be so courtly, so charming, and so blithely condemn half the earth in pursuit of a philosophical ideal. Chilled to the bone by this remark, I glanced, disbelieving, at Jemmy Madison, who had the grace to wince. As the crowds celebrated a new sister republic with a cannonade, all I could think of was the French king's downfall. This same king who'd come to our aid in the cause of independence. A king who'd put his fate into the hands of his people, the people who claimed to love him. And he'd been cruelly betrayed. I'd read in the papers that the French thronged to watch King Louis die, and cheered when the blade fell and severed his head. They stuffed the king head and all into a box. And afterward, the peasants wanted cuttings of his hair, scraps of his shirt, anything to mount upon a mantelpiece as a trinket. The public wanted to consume him. Like the hounds of hell, they even knelt and lapped up the king's blood. Here in America, some called that justice. And I couldn't help but shudder because I wore round my neck a pendant with a trinket of George Washington's hair. A man who'd just been unanimously re-elected to the presidency and sworn in for his second term, but was now derided as a tyrant in the making. Perhaps even by these very gentlemen standing beside me on the street corner, who I wanted to trust would never serve us up to a slavering public. What a high-minded thing revolution had seemed when it started. But now I wondered if, in trying to bring about liberty, we'd instead opened the gates of endless war, bloodshed, and immorality.
They're throwing a ball for the French ambassador, Citizen Genet, Lucy Knox huffed, perusing the lemon cake on Martha Washington's table before returning to her knitting. We Federalist ladies were always knitting, though I worried how easily it could all unravel. A country, a reputation, a marriage.
We were discussing the French ambassador, who was recruiting troops to fight for France in defiance of President Washington's proclamation of neutrality, and radical Francophiles in our country encouraged it.
"Surely you're mistaken, Mrs. General Knox,"
Abigail Adams replied, peering over the length of her sharp nose.
"These Democrats wouldn't host a ball. A ball is too aristocratic. It's to be an elegant civic repast that just happens to be held in the city's largest ballroom, where they're going to hand out liberty caps and sing La Marseillaise."
The ladies laughed, except for Lady Washington and me, because all I could think was that if French revolutionaries could kill a king and his ministers, Americans could kill a president and his treasury secretary.
Shrewdly eyeing the way my hands had stopped working my knitting needles, Abigail said, "Mr. Adams tells me we have our own Robespierres, but fortunately for us, they cannot persuade the people to follow them."
Thin-lipped, Lady Washington replied, I'd never have guessed Vice President Adams to be such an optimist. This did make me sputter with a laugh, a bitter one, because the people seemed entirely persuadable, especially as so-called democratic clubs sprang up around Philadelphia, based on the French Jacobin model. And I began to think nearly treasonous thoughts about this experiment with self-government. My husband couldn't even govern himself, not when passion took him. What hope did the common citizenry have of making wise decisions for themselves? My fears seemed justified when a few weeks later, 10,000 people were in the streets of Philadelphia threatening to drag Washington from his house and force us to join France's war against England.
Outside our door, men shouted, "Down with Washington!" They seemed to believe that by keeping America out of a costly foreign war, we were betraying our sister republic in France, that President Washington had turned his back on the values of the Revolution.
And I dared not go out, not even for church. Not when, clutching broadsheets depicting our president being sent to the guillotine, the mob screamed, "Enemies of equality, reform or tremble!" Instead, I kept the curtains closed and read the Bible to the children upstairs where we'd gathered them, afraid and trembling, into our bed. Nearly 9 years old, our daughter Anna was close to hysterical. Fanny, only a few months younger, sucked her thumb, as was her wont when she'd been a babe. While I rocked the littlest ones in my arms amongst a mountain of blankets Alexander had made for the boys, Anna cried, "Will they behead the president?" "I will never let such a thing happen," Alexander reassured us, very gravely. "Not while I draw breath." I knew that was true, but so too did anyone who wished to drag George Washington to the scaffold, which was why they would come for my husband first. Having finally coaxed the children to sleep in our bed with their favorite Dutch stories of elves and river Nixie, Alexander and I retreated to the divan in the back parlor, where a few candles still sputtered in the braziers on the wall. The protesters would return at dawn, but now, in the blessed quiet, I asked, "Are you not weary of all this?"
"More than you can know. Truly, this trade of a statesman is a sorry thing. But I cannot quit it. Otherwise, what's to become of our fame and glory?"
He gave a wry grin, one of his most appealing.
"How will the world go on without me? I am sometimes told very gravely that it could not."
He wanted me to laugh with him, but I didn't. It had been his habit for months now to crawl into bed with one of the boys at night, claiming that their sleep was troubled or that he didn't want to wake me. This was the fiction, the polite lie that allowed us to go on as if all was well. There was no intimacy between us now, and so I wanted no more lies either.
"All you do is fight,"
I whispered. "You fight Jefferson, you fight Madison and Burr, you fight the Jacobins, the Clintons, the Livingstons, the newspapers, the Congress, the French ambassador."
"And I beat them," Alexander replied. "You mustn't fear, my love. I will defend you and the children to my last breath."
He said this with fierce devotion, leaning over to kiss me. And I could hear my sister say, "Ah, Betsy, how lucky you were to get so clever and so good a companion." But I whispered,
"I could leave you."
I startled, as if the words had come from someone else's mouth.
Hamilton startled too, his eyes ablaze. "What?"
I straightened up, and this time I spoke clearly.
"I could leave you."
I'd scarcely allowed myself to acknowledge these thoughts, much less speak them aloud. But now the words mutinied upon my tongue, beyond my command. A divorce would be a scandal, but some society ladies quietly abandon their husbands if they have the means and inclination. Perhaps Alexander hadn't believed his sweet, docile wife could contemplate such a thing because he paled.
"Betsy, of all times to even muse,
Papa would take me back at the pastures," I said, idly twisting the interlocked gold bands of my wedding ring as my voice gained strength. "And his grandchildren, too.
I am not without options. There's only one thing that compels me to live with you, to cook your meals, to